Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
You might actually be the most derivative one of all. I mean, Christ, the same house.
Maybe so. But you forgot the first rule of surviving a stab movie. Never answer the...
I'm bored.
Wait!
And welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking sunglasses at night, we're talking music video editing, and we're talking she's that kind of woman. She's European. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and we're talking some sherry on some titties.
Oh boy, yes. Don't you just hate it when you're on a casual date and you happen to spill sherry all over your tits and you're like, better take the top off.
And your nipples just like pressing out, just begging to get out of that white t-shirt you're wearing. Yeah, absolutely.
My God, was somebody icing those nips? What was going on there?
I have to tell you. So, everyone, we were discussing Tony Scott's feature directorial debut, The Hunger, the famed lesbian vampire movie starring Susan Sarandon, David Bowie, and Catherine Deneuve. But, Joe, I have to say, I'm a little mad because my thing was going to be, she's that kind of woman. She's European.
It's such a fucking good line.
The delivery, Sarandon's delivery of that line, you're just like, womp womp.
I mean, she is European. Catherine Deneuve is very French.
Yes, very, very, very French. It's just code for lesbian vampire in this movie.
More or less, yeah.
More or less, but... Okay, so I think we need to get some estrogen in here, though, because we have a lot to talk about. So, everyone, our guest waiting in the wings is one half of the Spinsters of Horror, also known as the hosts of I Spit in Your Podcast, which is a monthly show in which they discuss horror, cult, and subversive movies with thoughtful analysis, research, and passion. You may have also seen her work at Anatomy of a Scream and Last Girls Club, or you may have heard her co-host on our previous episode on Bride of Chucky. Please welcome Jess of the Spinsters of Horror.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you guys about this film tonight.
I am too. So tell us, Jess, what is your connection with The Hunger? Have you like always been in love with this movie, or was this like a recent find for you?
I have always been in love with this film. So Kelly and I covered this film on our fourth episode of I Spit on Your Podcast. We did The Hunger and Interview with a Vampire, and I had learned a lot of things in that fourth episode. How thirsty Kelly and I both get when we talk about vampires.
Yes.
I learned about an editing mistake, about making sure I take things out of a podcast that Kelly doesn't make her sound as thirsty as she is, but now 5 years later, we all know that she's very thirsty.
Yeah.
But my history with this film is that Kelly showed me this film way back in the day when we were youngins going to Fan Expo in Toronto, when they used to have the Festival of Fear. And so every year I would go and visit Kelly and we would get together and watch a horror movie together. That was when I was starting my kind of like easing into horror. And obviously, you know, she was big into vampires. I'm big into vampires. And she had this movie on the shelf called The Hunger. And I was like, is that David Bowie? And she's like, yes. I'm like, as a vampire? She's like, yes. I'm like, well, then we have to watch this because A, we're huge like Labyrinth fans. So we're like, of course. And I watched it and I was just like, literally entranced by this film. And I was like, I have to own this film. And so I spent many years looking for it to have a copy of it for my little vampire collection that I was growing. And lo and behold, years later at the basement of a BMV in Toronto, I found it. And I love it. It's a film that I always go back to time and again. And I just love seeing it and I love watching it. And just, it's like a mood.
It is such a mood, isn't it? Right? Like, you know, I said in my intro that it's music video editing, and obviously anybody who's seen a Tony Scott film will kind of get a sense of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But this movie is gorgeous. Like, it is a vibe kind of film.
It really is. And I'm going to tell you right now, like, I haven't seen all of Tony Scott's filmography, but what I have seen, I don't love any of Tony Scott's films. I've never been in love with any of them. Mm-hmm. So when we first watched this movie, Joe, because everyone, we actually covered this before the podcast even began in our article series for Horror Queers back in 2018.
Ooh. Yep. This was actually our fourth editorial, Jess.
Wow, oh my God.
Oh my God, that's kismet.
But I wasn't dreading watching this movie, but I wasn't really looking forward to it because I was like, it's Tony Scott.
Oh my God, just admit it. Like, I reread the article today in advance of the recording, and like, we were both kind of assholes where we're like, I just don't know about this movie. I've heard a bunch about it. Isn't it just that lesbian vampire movie with Susan Sarandon?
Well, okay, but that's not on us. That is on the public, society, for making this the lesbian vampire movie.
True.
But truthfully, I had no connection to David Bowie. I'd never heard any of David Bowie's music until like recently. Honestly, it was after he died that I think that I really started to understand who David Bowie was and his importance to the queer community. But anyway, long story short, I really liked this. I was shocked at how much I enjoyed this. And I get the complaints or the criticisms of style over substance, but I still think there's enough substance here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I think I'm always a little surprised, always, the two times I've watched this movie, I am surprised that the runtime is about an hour 40 because the narrative is a little bit slight. And yet, the visuals, while they're doing plenty of heavy lifting, I think that there's enough meat here to make this very memorable on top of, you know, like really solid trio of performances, some interesting vampire lore. I'm a little iffy on the fact that we're dating this back to Egyptian times. Like, I forgot about the scene of Catherine Deneuve as an Egyptian. Was like, no.
Yeah, but that's a holdover from the source material, the novel it's based right on.
Yeah,
But it was a conscious decision to cut out whatever extra information that book would give us to just random flashbacks to where they almost seem superfluous to the plot of this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like it's just there to give us a sense of time. Ooh, she's real old. She's been doing this for a while.
And she got wider over time.
Yeah.
Apparently so.
Every time I finish this movie, I'm just like, oh, I have to go. I want to read the book. And I always remind myself, like, Jessica, look for that book so you can read it, because it goes along with all the vampire lore that I like to ingest and understand and stuff like that, because I love all these different interpretations of vampires. And I know the book goes more of a science fiction explanation to Miriam's vampirism, which I love.
That's okay. That's so interesting, because I was looking up like differences between the Hunger movie and the Hunger book. And of course, Googling the Hunger anything pulls up everything the Hunger Games. And I was like, mm-hmm. God damn it.
Yeah.
But I found an article. Well, actually, it was a review of the film and the book, and it was in one of those like academic like things where it's a PDF and you just subscribe. But I got a free article, I guess, and I was like, okay, cool. By this person's metrics, the movie's better. The first four chapters of the book are really, really, really good, and they only really pull quotes from the first 20 pages of the book. And apparently after that, it just all goes downhill. But they don't really say why, other than broad generalizations of like character motivations don't make sense. It feels really rushed. But it also reeked of it didn't go where I wanted it to go. So I would still say read the book. But this person did not have high opinions of it.
This person who doesn't have a name.
I would have given them a name if I pulled actual quotes from their article, but none of them were good enough, so I'm not going to give this person a name. Okay. So going into this, so as I said, yes, The Hunger was Tony Scott's feature directorial debut, is a loose adaptation of the 1981 novel of the same name by Whitley Strieber. Again, the only big difference is, you know, it fills in a lot of gaps in the background that the film only suggests in passing, like Miriam's Egyptian past, and the fact that, as Jess hinted at earlier, that the vampires are more of an alien race, which I found very interesting.
Well, there's one other sort of substantial difference, which is that Miriam lives and she's the one who continues and she kills Sarah.
Well, okay, I meant like general differences. We'll get to the ending of this movie.
Yeah, I was supposed to suggest that she's of another species, a species that lives forever.
Well, and I had a question about that, because a lot of things I read implied that Miriam was choosing not to kill her lovers when she could, because she loves them too much.
Oh, yeah. Totally. She does not want to let go.
I thought it was a death becomes her situation. I was like, no. Even if we dismember them and, like, spread their body parts all across the world, like, they are still alive. The heads are still conscious and talking.
I feel like we don't have quite enough information to know, but yeah, I definitely lean a little bit more towards Jess's interpretation, which is that she maybe could end it for them, but she chooses not to because she just can't let go.
Well, that's real bitchy.
I mean, if the shoe fits. She's a little possessive. She's a little all-controlling.
She's got some fear of death. She doesn't, she doesn't like death around her herself, but she doesn't want to let go of those she loves. So, yeah, it gets weird.
We just forget because it's Catherine Deneuve, and we're like, so pretty and elegant.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Yeah. Pretty people get away with everything. Haven't we learned anything from the real world?
I know. Me all the time, right?
Yes. European.
There is also, there's a depiction in the novel that John, the David Bowie character, as he loses his power, all the life force of each of the people he has killed to live off of all these years start to haunt him. So these personalities John has consumed into himself are starting to bleed out, so to speak, starting to leak through and haunt his imagination.
Oh, that's interesting.
That is interesting, yeah.
Yeah, we just don't have time for that in this movie.
I was going to say, that's kind of a whole other film, though, if you're going to go that route.
Well, and, as much as I like this film, it's really divided into two, right? We have the John half, and we have the Sarah half of this movie. And
yes.
I do empathize more with John because his plight seems kind of more, sad and relatable. I like Sarah as a character, but wish we had more time with her.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also difficult when you're kind of switching perspectives to a different character about midway through. Sarah's in the first half of the film, but it's like sporadic shots, we're introduced to her work colleagues and monkey shit. And then all of a sudden it's, hey, this is now your kind of main protagonist. You want to root for her. Well, I guess it depends on how you feel about Deneuve, but.
Well, I feel like she gets whatever, we'll talk about in the plot, but. Anyway, so the script came to Tony Scott through Dick Shepard, the president of MGM, though Shepard actually consulted with Alan Parker, the director of such films as Bugsy Malone, Midnight Express, Fame, and Pink Floyd The Wall, because he didn't trust Tony Scott, because Tony Scott was only known at this time for his work in commercials. But they were very stylish, they were very artsy, and so at the end of the day, he wound up going with Tony Scott. The film is set in New York. They couldn't shoot there because of the budget. They got a good deal to shoot in London, so they did that, with the New York filming pretty much relegated to exterior shots to make it look like we're actually in New York City.
I mean, fair. The vast majority of this film does take place indoors.
Yeah, exactly. It's that house, right? The house and the lab. And this weird restaurant with a pool in it.
I love the pool restaurant.
I also can't speak to how close it is to this film, but in the commentary on the Blu-ray, Tony Scott says that this film was inspired by Nicholas Roeg's first movie, 1970's Performance, which stars James Fox as a violent and ambitious London gangster who, after killing an old friend, goes into hiding at the home of a reclusive rock star played by none other than Mick Jagger.
Who has purportedly had sexual relations with David Bowie.
Who has had sexual relations with Susan Sarandon.
Ooh. Okay, you know what? We have unlocked a conspiracy here.
No, it was so funny because in the IMDb trivia for this, it was like in an interview with Daily Beast in 2014, Susan Sarandon admitted to having an affair with David Bowie. And I was like, well, I'm going to check that really quick because I don't trust the IMDb trivia. Nope, I found that interview and she definitely does say David Bowie. I fucked David Bowie.
Wow. You know what? Good for them.
This would have been, because I'm assuming it's during the making of this, but it would have been a year before she had her first marriage to the Amuri guy.
Okay.
But no, I digress. I did want to mention a fun connection to last week's film, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, when it comes to the score for this film. Because while we do have two composers credited on this film, and that's Michel Rubini and Denny Yeager, they had like a synthesizer score with some electronics by David Lawson. We also have, in this case, a musical director because Tony Scott wanted to create a score largely using classical music. So while we don't have a composer doing all that, we have someone in charge of that. And if you all listened to our episode last week, we couldn't find a composer for Sacred Deer because there was none.
Right. Yeah.
Oh.
But anyway, The Hunger was released on April 29th, 1983, against fellow newcomers Something Wicked This Way Comes and A Valley Girl. It opened in the number 5 spot behind those two films, as well as Flashdance and Tootsie. It only got $1.8 million, eventually going on to gross $6 million domestically, and a whopping $9,000 overseas, which...
Oof.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do not know the budget of this film. I could not find the budget anywhere. So I would imagine, because I feel like I've always seen this film referred to as a disappointment. I don't know if it was an outright flop, but the critical bashing was so, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but I don't think this was a success for anyone involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you and I glommed onto when we did that editorial was that it's not just that the film is perceived as a bit of a financial flop, but it's like, it just didn't get spoken about unless you were working within certain communities. Like, I think this film has a different reputation among queer audiences and maybe mm-hmm. horror audiences, but I think to the population at large, it was just kind of that artsy lesbian vampire movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of when I first heard about it. I mean, look, it had enough of a reputation to get a sci-fi, I'm sorry, not sci-fi, an anthology TV series spinoff that aired on Showtime in the States, and I want to say the Movie Channel in Canada, but it was like a Tales from the Crypt type thing, but it was only 2 seasons, but David Bowie was like the Crypt Keeper-esque host of the second season.
Oh, that's wild.
Right? And Tony Scott actually directed the premiere episode of the first season. So, I mean, like, I'd never heard of this.
I feel like I know I've seen that in the wild. Like, when I was a kid in, like, a Walmart video store seeing, like, a DVD mm-hmm. of, like, The Hunger Season 2. And I'm like, that's mm-hmm. David Bowie. Because I knew David Bowie from Labyrinth because I was still young. But, oh, wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. Right? This movie. But I think that is a testament to the film's enduring cult status. Because, Joe, as you said, those two audiences, also apparently the goth audience, which maybe has crossover with horror.
Jazz, would you like to comment?
This movie is very gothic, very gothy, and yes, very popular among the gothy, dark, vampire, lesbian ladies. Like, you hear Baja's Bela Lugosi's Dead playing in any lesbian woman's area, and we're like, uh-huh, yes. Good times.
It's like every lesbian has to have a vinyl of that song in their apartment at all times.
I mean, it's a fucking good song, too.
Undead, undead, undead. That's what I got out of that song. But who did not like this movie were many critics of the at the time. So, granted, on Rotten Tomatoes, we're looking at a 56% with an average score of 5.7 out of 10. The film received mixed reviews, with criticism going toward its pacing, its plot, heavy on atmosphere. I know we don't like to give a lot of airtime to Ebert because his opinions on most horror movies suck, but he called this an agonizingly bad vampire movie, which I would maybe understand that if he backed it up more, but his review, which is fairly brief, consists of him talking about the lesbian sex scene.
Wow. I'm sitting there like my eyes popping out of my head. I'm like, has he not seen Blood Rain? That's a terrible vampire movie.
Well, he hadn't seen it in 1983.
True. But I'm sitting just thinking of like all the worst horrible vampire movies out there and be like, oh my God, why?
Well, I think the other weird thing is that like at this point, we would have had a bunch of Hammer horror that would have dealt, mm-hmm. frankly, quite explicitly with lesbian vampires.
Exactly.
And granted, yes, those are more often European and maybe they hadn't crossed the pond. But like when you watch this, it does feel like it's a little tepid about its vampirism, like the movie doesn't even want to say vampire. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think to say that, to me, belittles... Well, I sent you this in a text message, Trace. It feels like it's very straight male energy to be like, this vampire movie isn't very vampire-y. Let me talk to you about the sex scene.
Well, I mean, granted, he does say there's no story there, but he doesn't go on to really talk about it. He mentions it's like a throwaway line. I'm like, dude, like, what is
wrong
with
this movie? Review?
Yeah, like, give me the review. And what's funny is, though, we're talking about Hammer horror. British critics specifically were very, very mean to this movie, which is because Tony Scott's British. And you know what it reminds me of is the reception to Michael Powell and Peeping Tom in Britain, because it was harsher over there than it was in the States.
Right.
But, I mean, he talks about how reading the reviews for this movie, so they called it artsy, esoteric, and self-indulgent. And I love...
Yes. Why are those bad things?
Well, so esoteric, because admittedly, I will not lie, I did not know what that word meant, so I looked it up. And it's just a fancy way of saying it's not for me, or I'm not the built-in audience for this movie.
Yeah, it's like a finite thing. You know, certain people will appreciate it. I maybe am not one of them.
Mm-hmm. Which... That, to me, is weird to use as a critique against something.
Because it's bad criticism.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah, 100%. It's just a fancy word.
Well, nevertheless, because of the reception for this movie, Tony Scott was not able to make another film for 3 years, which would, of course, go on to be Top Gun. So he saved himself. But he didn't read reviews for any of his films again until Man on Fire in 2004.
Oh, and he got good reviews for that one, so he was safe.
They were mixed, but the funny thing is the only reason he read a review is because someone said, oh, don't read A.O. Scott's New York Times review of this movie. And he was at a hotel, and the New York Times was just on the coffee table, and he was like, I was like an addict, and I had to read it. But yeah, Letterboxd users, nevertheless, have given it a much higher 7 out of 10 average rating, so at least we have that.
Yeah, that seems a little more on par with what I would expect.
I think it's, you know, contemporary, you know, just reappraisals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that's all I got. There was not really any drama in the making of this movie. And Susan Sarandon is on the commentary, but it's one of those ones where they clearly recorded Scott and Sarandon in separate times, and they just spliced their audio together.
Okay.
Hmm. I know. I hate that.
You can't get everything. Mm-mm. Okay, so this movie begins with the credits playing, but we're kind of intercutting with scenes where the camera is perched behind a grate looking into a blue-lit club, because this movie is nothing if not blue.
Which is surprising, given how green and orange Tony Scott would lean into in the latter part of his career.
I mean, I think what we're discovering is that he liked a certain kind of color palette, right?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're seeing the lead singer of the Bauhaus. Nope. So we're seeing the lead singer of the Bauhaus. What?
Just, is it just Bauhaus? I think it's just that. Bauhaus.
Bauhaus. Yeah. Bauhaus.
Bauhaus. Okay. Bauhaus. So we're seeing the lead singer of the Bauhaus, Peter Murphy. He is singing Bela Lugosi's Dead. And amidst this, we're also seeing strobe lights flashing, people dancing. It's a very interesting mix. Like, you could call this kind of new wave in terms of the way people's hair is styled. But then we're also getting kind of retro 40s sort of dominatrix kink wear, like lots of leather, sunglasses at night. It's an interesting combination.
For myself, like, for seeing this scene as like a wannabe goth, I was like entranced. I was like, right. This is what I want. This is where I want to be. I want to be at this club, even though I'll probably be hiding in the back being a weirdo just watching everyone because they're so beautiful.
Well, in that case, then, you would be like Miriam, Catherine Deneuve, and John David Bowie, because they're not engaging with this at all. They're just kind of taking it all in. Although, it sounds like, Jess, you maybe wouldn't be there to shop for eye candy that you could bring back to your flat and, you know, fuck and bleed to death. Well, maybe. I don't know what you do on the weekends.
For a second, I was like, who says I wouldn't?
You don't know me. Don't make those assumptions.
Ooh, I will say, though, this movie, I mean, I know it's the 80s, but making cigarette smoking look real fucking sexy.
Right?
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Man. Every scene of Catherine Deneuve, I'm just like, oh, my God, queen. Smoke it.
Well, the other interesting thing to me is I don't know how much these films would have overlapped, but I mean, we're talking about Tony Scott. The year before, Ridley Scott would have released Blade Runner, and it has a very similar kind of like smoky, futuristic, very distinctively lit, very distinctively styled film in Blade Runner.
Like, really trying to bring you into this world. Like, you're brought in, you can feel the energy, the atmosphere. Like, you almost want, you want to be in this world. Like, I know whenever I watch Blade Runner, I'm like, I want to be in that world.
Right. Yeah, it really immerses you, particularly in the early scenes when you're trying to do the world building and establish these characters. They both have such a distinctive visual eye.
Well, even some of the framing in this movie, too. Like, something that stuck out to me the most in this film is that we have a lot of things where the focal point of what we're supposed to be looking at is not in the center of the screen. He likes to put them on the left side or the right side of the screen very often.
Yeah, because that usually ends up giving you sort of free range to look at other things, or it creates tension because you're wondering what's going to come into the frame to fill it.
Right? It's just like, it's off. But nothing does, which is what I find so fascinating about this film. I mean, it is stylish, and it is gorgeous to look at, but to me, it makes up for a lot of those narrative shortcomings.
Right. Yeah. Like, you're never bored because there's always something interesting to look at, even if narratively it's a little simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things, since we are talking about the look of the film and the way that we watch it, is particularly as we lead into the sex scene, which is arguably the most famous part of this movie, apart from maybe the fact that Bowie is in it, is the gaze. Because I think some people have lobbied criticism against this movie for saying, well, this is based on a book by a man, screenplay written by a man, directed by a man, and then we've got, you know, this very infamous lesbian sex scene in it. So it's very male gazey.
And
I think that we can have some interesting conversations about how specifically the sex scene is shot. But I would also argue that I think the film does encourage more than a heterosexual male perspective because of the way that both Bowie and Deneuve and Sarandon are shot.
Yeah, I was going to say, honestly, I mean, like we could talk about the male gay shit when we get to the sex scene itself, but even the way it's shot, like, to me, that scene is so erotic more than it is sexual, I guess, if that makes any kind of sense. Like, it feels classy. Like, that sex scene, I love the way that scene is shot. It is so beautiful. It's so erotic, but it doesn't, I don't know, I personally don't get, like, a gross male gazy thing out of it, but, you know, maybe I'll disagree.
Well, how about we'll wait and we'll talk about it when we get there.
Yeah.
I guess the reason I wanted to bring up gaze specifically early on is because we do have our two quote-unquote leads at this point looking at people. But I thought it was interesting how the way both are framed, like, they're incredibly gorgeous individuals, like Bowie and Deneuve. Incredible bone structure. The way that they're lit in the movie, they always, you know, they look visually pleasing because they are young and perfect because, you know, they're monsters and they're feasting on blood and so on. But I found a piece that I'll refer to a couple times throughout this by Deborah Michelle called The Proprietary Cinematic Gaze in Tony Scott's The Hunger, and it's from a website called Acidemic, which I was like, okay, that is an interesting play on academic. But Michelle says, the spectator's gaze might be that of a heterosexual male, but it might also be a gay or bisexual male or female gaze, which appreciates the images of both Miriam and John. The slippage of gender in the assumed spectatorial gaze and on the screen represents only the first in a series of border transgressions to come. Masculine and feminine, sex and violence, animal and human, love and death all shift uneasily like quicksand in this narrative.
Okay, cool. So there you go.
Well, again, look, I raised it because I wanted to read the quote.
No, and that's a great quoted idea because as I'm thinking of like the casting for this film, right? Like you could have cast anyone to play John, the vampire, you know, Miriam's lover, but you choose David Bowie. Someone who transgresses gender all the time, right?
Right.
Like, there's a femininity that goes with this character of John that it almost makes sense when Miriam starts to transfer her affections to Sarah because there's a similarity between them. There's that, like, that feminine connection that you just can't help but think, like, and so I agree with Trace when you say, like, male gazy. I don't see, like, there is a sense of some male gaze, but it plays with you because there's points where I'm just like, okay, this is gorgeous. I'm not offended by this at all. Like, I would look at, I would admire this woman at that way as well.
Well, you're totally right, Jess. I mean, I think one of the things that people sometimes overlook in the film is, like, Bowie is incredibly androgynous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, he's known for his androgyny. And then the way that Sarandon is styled in the movie, like, yes, it's very 83. Like, her haircut is of that era. And yet she is also, to a certain extent, very androgynous, right? So it does feel like we're sort of swapping one in for the other. And then, of course, Deneuve, in a way, could be said to embody both the masculine and the feminine because she's very hard. She's very controlling. She has all these kind of traditionally masculine qualities to her, but then she's also seductive and soft, like the way she wears her hair is both at once. So I think that the film is very interested in traditional depictions of gender and sexuality, and it wants to play with them.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And that's what makes it so interesting. Like, that's part of the reason why I'm never bored watching this movie, because it's all of that coupled with the fact that this is 1983.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? Like, when we talk about the vampire, the queer vampire movies from the 80s, we're usually talking about Fright Night, which is 85, mm-hmm. and then we're talking about Lost Boys, which is 87, 88.
I think it's 87, mm-hmm. yeah.
So it's like, this one is the original one, and obviously not the first queer vampire film ever made.
But it's more explicitly queer than both Fright Night and Lost Boys.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yes, yeah, it's less coded, more upfront.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we've said, Miriam and John are basically hunting, but in a sexy way. So the next scenes that we see are intercut with the two of them in a car with a couple who are played by Anne Magnuson and John Stephen Hill. These two do not get names because they're basically just here to provide some fuckery when we get back to the house. And then all of a sudden, these Ankh necklaces transform into mini daggers and we're killing people and just washing our hands of it.
Is it cultural appropriation that they're using Ankh daggers?
I mean, Ankh is definitely an Egyptian symbol. Sure, we learn later it means everlasting life, but it's kind of like,
well. Well, like, if it connects to her connection to being in Egypt, but even then we're like, ooh, a little iffy with that. And
you're French,
like,
lady.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, right?
Ma'am, you are a white French lady. I guess what's interesting to me is that this feels like a subversion of what we would traditionally expect. Like, usually in vampire films, you see crosses, right?
Yes.
And that is wholly absent from this movie.
Well, what I love about this movie, though, is how it plays with vampire lore. Like, these fuckers can walk around in the daylight. There's no fangs. They have to use weapons to bleed their people. And, right. I mean, we'll talk about the way that you become a... I mean, it's always, you know, AIDS-y. But I feel like, specifically in this movie, it really... Like, you can have that AIDS reading about it more explicitly than some other vampire movies at the time.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so we neglected to mention that we are introduced technically to Sarah and her coworker Phyllis briefly in this scene, because as we're seeing these humans get cut up by these Ankh necklaces, we're also watching a couple of monkeys murder each other. Well, the male monkey murders the female monkey, and it's very provocative in the way that it's edited. So even though we're not actually seeing a lot of violence, we're seeing... Well, even though we're not seeing a lot of gore, we're seeing a lot of violence.
Well, it's because we cross-cut a lot in this movie when we're having, like, violent scenes or sexual scenes like this. And I think it's kind of fun. I think it's kind of... Because I saw that quote from Bowie where he talks about how, oh, there's nothing like that looks like it on the market, but it is kind of a rather gory... Like, he wasn't really pleased with the gore in the film. But that's one of those things where I'm like, I don't really think the film is that particularly violent, but maybe it's one of those things where it's like, he's filming it, so there's... He wound up seeing a lot more blood when they were filming, and the editing cuts around it a lot.
Mm. And I feel like it gets violent because of the way the film goes. Like, everything is so nice, pretty, like, morning, like everything's so slow, and then all of a sudden it's just, like, violence, and then it's done.
Right.
Like, it just happens so jarringly, like, each time it happens. And you get the loud, like, striking music that goes with it as well that really ignites that in the film.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jess, because so much of this film, I think in our editorial trace, I mentioned that this sometimes feels like it's an elaborate, ornate perfume commercial.
Yeah. The opening of the film looks like a music video or a commercial. Like, it immediately transports you into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The beginning of the movie is a music video, and then later on, it's like, we're doing flowy linens in the breeze with the fog machine.
The sheath is so many sheets.
I mean, that's really why they didn't make their money back, is because they spent all of their money on sheets.
Egyptian cotton sheets.
Oh my God, Trace.
Only the best.
Only the best for Miss Deneuve.
Yeah, so after the violence, we do get to watch Miriam and John basically pack up these bodies, put them in the back of the truck, and then incinerate them in the, frankly, industrial-looking incinerator that they have in the basement of this New York townhouse.
Well, okay, this... I need to see a map of this place, because yes. Not only do they have it incinerated, but they have this enormous attic that she snuck 20 coffins in two holding her dead lovers that no one noticed.
I remember making that note being like, this would be like a logistic nightmare. But like, I need to find a townhouse that has this specific specs all around and stuff like that. And then I also thought, I'm like, oh my God, this is also a perfect place for froggers. This is terrifying. I don't like any of this at all.
Oh my God. In case you don't know, it's PH frog, froggers, people that hide in your attic and live in your house without you knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
I mean, they basically own a small size building in New York. And I get it. You know, when we see it, it's house porn for days. We've got Miriam outfitting this place with really, really expensive looking pieces of art. At one point, I think Sarah says, oh, I love this piece. And you're just like, bitch, that's probably from real ancient Egypt. But, you know, yeah, have at it. So clearly they have money. But I think this is at least a 5 or 6 story walk up with, yes, an incinerator, an elevator, and an open air attic.
And also something I noticed too, this is like the first time I noticed in seeing this movie so many times, when they kill the couple from the club, they kill them at a different house.
Yes, they have a second location.
Yes. So I'm like, they have a murder location. And then they drive back with the bodies to incinerate them. So I was just like, mm-hmm. Oh, I never noticed that before.
Yeah, they fully have a second place that they just use to murder people in.
You know what?
That is opulent.
Good for them. see, they need to be hanging out with Tilda Swinton and what's-his-face and Only Lovers Left
Alone. Oh, yes. Yeah, okay.
Because isn't that set in the 80s, too? Well, even if it's not, they need to hang out with them.
There we go. They can just be sad and mopey together.
Exactly.
So speaking of sad and mopey, we do see John is not sleeping. So even though Miriam is fully satiated after all of this, she's completely passed out. John is wide awake in bed. He is remembering this memory that we see of the two of them. Seems to be set about 200 years prior, some kind of Victorian nonsense, likely French, because they got the big, Marie Antoinette kind of wig thing going on. And we'll come to eventually suss out that this is when he was first turned. So he's reflecting back on when it all began because, spoiler alert, he's about to start dying.
But I appreciate these scenes more in a rewatch. They are quick cutaways, quick flashes. Mm-hmm. But I feel like in a, maybe not even a lesser film, but a different film, we would be getting full on like flashback scenes to this. And honestly, ain't nobody got time for that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love the movie, but ladies and gentlemen, I give you Highlander.
I don't know what that means.
It's a movie called Highlander.
I know what the movie is. How does that compare to what I just said?
You mean like all like the memory scenes when McCloud has like all those long memories and you're like, okay, let's get back to the film that we were actually here for.
There are whole chunks of that movie where it's just like, I'm remembering my past from the Scottish Highlands. And you're just like, oh, Jesus Christ, we got 10 minutes of Sean Connery doing a bit on a boat.
I didn't know. I don't know what Highlander is about. Everyone always talks about it. But
oh my God, Trace.
It's so good.
Which one is Endgame? Because I feel like that one was always advertised on the Sci-Fi Channel when I was growing up. So my knowledge of Highlander is whatever Highlander Endgame is.
Oh, wow.
That's like 4?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What you need to do is watch the first Highlander and watch Sean Connery, a Scottish man, eat an Egyptian man.
Oh my God.
And then you need to go and watch the second one.
Yes, but
then you
the have second to find one is great.
But there's two different versions, and you have to watch them both, and then report back.
Oh, that sounds like none of this sounds good to me. Oh, it's Russell
McKay.
It's not.
Okay.
I would argue, I love the lore of Highlander, though. Like,
yes,
I mean, we're talking about the lore in The Hunger, and it's kind of non-existent, right? Like, you really just have to fill in those gaps yourself unless you're going to read that source material. Highlander is like, let us tell you everything. We're going to build this whole secret society where you got to go around chopping off other people's heads to accumulate their power. And it plays out over centuries.
Jesus Christ. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for Highlander franchise. And I'm like, there's so many words about this franchise. is.
And what
I love, it is legitimately great.
It is legitimately great. And what I love is that they constantly change the origins. And that's why when you watch the second one, and there's like two different versions of the second movie, you're just like, wait, so what's going on? Now, what is their origin story? Because I just believed all this, and now it's all this.
You might have to program that,
Clancy Joe, because Brown is the villain in the first film.
Okay, well, you might have to program it, because I can almost guarantee I will never just watch this movie.
Because here's the other thing, Trace. Did you see who Connor McLeod is?
It's Christopher Lambert, the guy from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, but he's supposed to be like an American and or a Scotsman. So imagine Christopher Lambert with his French as fuck accent being like, hey, yes, I am Scottish.
Okay, yeah, no, I was like, that's the voice he has in Mortal Kombat. Mm-hmm. I get him confused with Dexter's dad because Dexter's dad is he replaces him in the second Mortal Kombat movie.
Correct. Yes.
Anyway, I'm sorry, y'all. Fun Highlander tangent. I'm never going to watch it. Back to the hunger.
Back to the hunger. Yeah. So, well, John thinks about the end of his life. We spend a little bit of time with Sarah and her colleagues. So she has a female colleague named Phyllis, who is played by Suzanne Burdish, as well as this kind of asshole guy named Tom, who we will eventually come to realize is actually Sarah's boyfriend.
Wait, I'm curious, what makes him an asshole?
He's just like every generic white dude.
Yes.
Like, he's so basic and plain. And it's mostly the way that he reacts when they go out for dinner and he's like, how come you got the steak? You don't seem very hungry.
Okay.
And you're just okay, dude, take it down a notch.
I agree with him being a basic white dude, but let's not forget that his girlfriend was gone with some woman for 3.5 hours and he's right because she did cheat on him.
Yeah, but I mean, two women could just be hanging out, having a good time chatting. He has no right to grill her about it, being like, well, I'm all suspicious. You can't talk to someone for 3.5 hours you just met. I'm like, yeah, I could.
I don't think he even suspects that she had a sexual affair because I think that would be beyond his limited capabilities. I think he's just like, you were gone for 3 hours and I want to know where you were. What were you talking about? I'm trying to control your life.
I am always the one defending asshole men on this podcast.
This is true. Why do you feel the need, Trace?
I don't even care. He is. He's a boring, generic white dude who will get killed by the end of this movie. But let's not mistake the fact that Sarah is not doing a good job covering up her lie in this movie.
I would argue that the film tells us that they are not a good fit for one another.
No, but I'm just, you know what?
You're still trying to do it, and I don't know why.
I know. I'm just like,
maybe it's because of the glasses scene when he's looking in the bathroom and he's putting on the black sunglasses. He's like, "Yeah, I'm really cool."
Well, maybe. No. Hey, look, I am not defending an asshole at all. All I'm saying is I do understand where he's coming from a bit because the way she reacts to any of his questions is not convincing in the slightest. As someone who I think is a pretty good liar myself, she's not a good liar.
She's a little defensive.
Yes.
Anyway, all this to say, so we're talking about monkey death and monkey murder here. And it's important to note that, we're learning that Sarah is involved in both blood research, but also anti-aging. So that's one of the things that they were doing with these monkeys.
Don't you love that when a movie like deals with a very, very niche specific thing in its plot? And then it's like, oh, good, we had this character who happens to be an expert on the field.
I mean, I would argue that that's why Sarah is in this movie, though. It just so happens that she's like hot young Susan Sarandon. But the reason that they go to her is because she is explicitly doing the thing that they are trying to solve.
Oh, yeah. I'm just saying, it's really nice and convenient for them that she's in the same city as them, that she's doing talk show appearances with her new book about this exact topic when they need it most.
Exactly. You know what? It's New York is the city of dreams, baby. They really have everything for you.
Like, the only way that I could think that Miriam would know all about this is Sarah's, because Miriam knows that these people will eventually die. So maybe at some point she heard something in the wind of be like, oh, they're actually doing a study on anti-aging. And that's reading more into it.
So apparently in the novel, she has been following Sarah for a while, like following her research. Okay. And even a tidbit like that, I'm like, okay, cool. I mean, look, it's not really an issue. I don't really care because it's not the point of the movie. But even like a little like throwaway line, like I've been following your work for a decade. Be like, okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you are meant to think, oh, it is fortuitous, but also there's a lot of implied, there's something about the relationship between particularly Sarah and Miriam in this movie where it's kind of like, well, we were always destined to do this. Like, we have such an influence over each other, or rather, Miriam does over Sarah.
Yeah. Definitely. Which, I mean, it's, even though I called Miriam a bitch or a cunt, one of those things earlier, I still feel so bad for her because I get it. I do get it. But her behavior is so toxic in this film. I don't think I realized that until after a first viewing where I was like, oh, wait, she's really not a good person.
No, she's definitely the villain. She's the monstrous villain in this movie. It's just, it's so easy to forget that because Deneuve is so fucking gorgeous and her performance is so regal. I don't know how you don't cheer for Miriam in this movie, even as your brain is telling you, oh no, she's fully just like murdering people and lying to all of her lovers and kind of being a horrible garbage individual.
Man, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I mean, like, I don't find this movie particularly scary, but the fates of her lovers, it like, oh, even thinking awful about it, it like gives me chills.
Yeah, it's terrifying to be like essentially like, I'm just gonna live dying and decaying in this box for the rest of my life.
Well, I'm sorry, for the rest of, which is all eternity.
Yes. Bye. See your new
don't
friends.
Don't mind me. I'm just
going to
put the lid on the coffin.
Take care like, of
at
them,
least,
everyone
at
else.
At least put them all in a chair, like in a circle of chairs, so they can all sit and stare at each other.
You imagine coming into that scene, like just walking through Miriam's ooh house and be like, wow, there's just a bunch of rotting corpses sitting in chairs in this room.
Well, I think
the
they're
door
dry corpses. I don't think dry corpses can rot. They're just dry. They're okay, very dry.
I don't know. That attic is open to the elements. Like, all you need is a little bit of rain. Those fuckers are getting moist.
But, yeah.
See, once you start, like, breaking into it all, you're like, this is not as romantic as it should look.
No, this is grody.
It's Scott's filmmaking that makes it look romantic. So he did 100%.
His job. He did. Yeah. 100%. Well, no, before we go further on, when I first saw this film and saw Susan Sarandon's character, Sarah, I was like, holy crap, she is hot. And I remember when I first met her as an actor in Rocky Horror Picture Show, I was like, meh, she's okay. And then when I saw her there, I was like, I know.
Okay,
but like,
wait, no, it's so funny because I'm not even the biggest fan of Rocky Horror. I think it's fine. I appreciate it. I respect it. It's not a film that I particularly like to go to. I love
her. It's too esoteric for you?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's not for me. No, it's so, because my favorite part of the whole movie is when they're doing the Brad, John, Rocky, Brad, John, Rocky. And I just think she's so good at that moment.
Well, she looks so cute seeing that film, which I know is what she's supposed to be in that film. And I just remember, you know, and when I saw both this, The Hunger, and also Rocky Horror Picture Show, I was like, I was in my queer, like, I am queer, but like, I was out, like, dating a woman and stuff like that. So it was just like, oh, she's cute. Like, you know, and then I see her in The Hunger. I was like, wow. Okay. Damn, girl.
See, I was trying to think of the first thing that I saw Sarandon in. I think it was Stepmom. I think Stepmom or The Client. Oh, my God. And so I've only known her as, like, that Moms type. I didn't know her during her sex, like, her sexual, sex symbol era. And that's it. That's all I have to say.
I mean, I fully agree with you, Jess. I think all three leads in this movie are incredibly gorgeous and stylish, but it feels like Sarandon is the shock to younger viewers because we aren't used to seeing her looking like this. Like, when she's got the bright red lipstick on and that hair is just so, even in, you know, just the white t-shirt, when she shows up and she's angry, you're just like, yeah, I get it. Okay, so we should mention that John and Miriam do have a line that they repeat to each other over and over, and it is forever, forever and ever, because that is the promise that Miriam makes to all of these lovers, is that they will be young and they will be together forever because they are a part of her.
Man, there's some fine print on that fucking contract.
Jesus, yeah, it's like, oh, did you not read the small 8-font writing the asterisks at the bottom of the page?
It's actually semantics, because she doesn't lie. They will be together forever and ever.
This is true. Mm-hmm.
He's just not going to be young forever and ever.
She just kind of covers the truth a little bit. She's just like, we'll be together forever. As she's not looking at him as he's aging. She's like, forever.
Mm-hmm. Definitely forever.
Mm-hmm. She's like looking up at the attic. Like she hears something. She's like, shut up over there.
I mean, my thing is also like, did you not notice that we're also transporting at least a half dozen coffins every time we move to a new location? Who do you think is in there?
Well, he's a man. He's a man. He's
stupid.
And he doesn't notice things.
Well, I think it's also, to me, a lot of this film is very much about being accustomed to the life that you have grown into, right? Yeah. Like, the reason that John is so angry with her later on is because she made him this promise, and it's been 200 years. But on the flip side, dude, you got 200 more years than most people would ever get. So,
okay, but the trade-off, here's the thing. Would you rather live a regular length of life and die? Or would you rather get 200 years to do whatever the fuck you wanted at the age of 30, but then after that 200 years be doomed to live in a box for all eternity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and sucks. Also, during those 200 years, you also become an addict to blood.
That too. And something I picked up in this was also their loss of identity. Because John doesn't really know who he is. He's lived his life as Miriam has wanted them to live their lives. And
exactly. Well,
we haven't introduced this character yet, Alice, but she makes a comment later in the film about like, oh, I know everything about Miriam. She's like my best friend, da-da-da. Mm-hmm. I know nothing about John.
Yep.
He's like mystery to me. And you're like, oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm not saying I want this, but there is a way to do a TV show version of this where you have the Catherine Deneuve character as your main character across all the seasons, but every season is a different lover. So a different time period, different lovers.
Ooh.
That would be interesting.
I love that. Like, have, anyway, sorry.
Yes, you're very fond of your own idea, Trace.
I am. I'm so smart.
Okay, so where are we? Actually, so yes, we are on the verge of introducing music student Alice, who is played by Beth Ehlers. And I think that this young actor is a very kind of cute and plucky, giving me Jodie Foster vibes.
I was going to say Jodie Foster
Taxi Driver and stuff.
Well, because speaking of androgyny, I legit thought this was a long-haired boy for most of her first scene.
It could go either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It, like, I think deliberately so, though. Like, the movie wants you to play with this. I think it's one of the reasons why Miriam might have even been attracted to Alice to take on this girl as a student.
Well, and she, and that's the other thing, too. So it's implied in the film, it's explicit in the book, that she was grooming Alice to be John's replacement. But she was taken aback because John's degradation happened sooner than she
so
expected.
Quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it was only 200 years, where I think in the past her lovers had at least 300 years.
That is wild. And also very Interview with the Vampire.
Yes!
Oh, yeah. So, and because I just see Alice as, like, their surrogate child, right? Like, they can't actually have children together, so they have this, you know, neighbor child that they play music with and stuff like that, and they've grown to, but to be, actually be grooming her.
Oh, yeah, she's a groomer.
Oh, God. No, we don't use that word.
No, rude.
This movie's homophobic.
Ugh. It's interesting, though, right? Like, I think Alice is a fascinating character because in some ways we know nothing about this girl. She exists to give us information about John and Miriam.
Yeah.
So from a storytelling perspective, it's like, this is a nothing character, but what she does to tell us about our two leads is very important. And yet, I find Alice makes such a huge impression in just these couple of scenes that she's in.
I agree, but I actually needed to see Miriam's reaction to finding Alice's corpse or knowing that John killed Alice. That's, I needed that because I think that's where, again, the implication is that, yeah, she was going to groom Alice to be her next lover. And her death doesn't really factor into this film whatsoever emotionally.
Yeah.
I think it's because it happens at the moment where John has really hit the wall, right? Like, he has decomposed to such a state at that point that Miriam kind of has to deal with him before she can do anything. But I agree with you. It's not quite enough to see, oh, here's a Polaroid on the floor. Oh, shit. I know what that means. And then just cut to her looking at the incinerator.
Dude, yeah. But, you know, one of my favorite shots in this movie is the music pages as they fall on the floor and the blood soaks through them.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
That's so stylish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If murder could be said to be stylish.
It's very striking for, especially in a horror film, murder of a child. That's a no-no.
Well, actually, because we've talked about the blue color palette, but I actually think that helps the red. The few times we do get to see blood in this movie, it really stands out.
Mm, yeah, I agree.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the other things, when I mentioned Blade Runner, I was also thinking about some of the films that have influenced that movie, which is film noir. Like, a lot of this movie, The Hunger, yeah, looks like it could be a film noir. And, like, Miriam is a femme fatale, right? Like,
yeah,
she's kind of androgynous. She's super controlling with her sexuality. She's basically emasculating all the men around her. And the color palette, well, yes, very blue. It has that kind of chiaroscuro lighting, and the blue could be mistaken for a sort of black and white aesthetic. But then when we get the red, it just pops, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were we talking about where I tried to say chiaroscuro? I didn't know. I'd read it many times before. I just had never tried to say it out loud.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those words where you're like, who the fuck says this word out loud?
Film scholars.
And podcasters, apparently. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so John is rapidly falling ill. We have to excuse Alice because this lesson is not going to go ahead, even though we keep striking on this idea of people are afraid to get old. We want to talk about immortality. So we're really bringing Dr. Sarah's research in on what we're seeing of, like, news clips and her in the lab with John's decline in general health, right?
Yes.
So I love this idea that after Alice leaves, it's just such a simplistic visual shot. No words needed. He goes into the bathroom and he sees that he has wrinkles under his eyes.
I'm sorry. I really want to mention this. Sorry. I did pull a quote from the book about Alice. Not to go backwards again, but...
No, you're fine.
So this is it's not a like a character dialogue, but it's just an internalized monologue, and it's for Miriam. But it says, her thoughts went to little Alice Cavender, whom she would transform. When John's winter actually came, many years from now, Alice would be rising to summer. As he withered, she would flower, and Miriam's love would slip from one to the next with none of the agonizing sense of loss she had experienced in the past. And that's why it's a surprise whenever John starts declining, because she's like, wait, this child needs to get a little bit older.
Wait, I had this like a poetic romantic idea of how this was all going to go, and now it's all getting fucked up.
And that's actually, because I do want to read the book for that reason, though, because I feel like you'll be in Miriam's head a bit more, and it's going to be a very fascinating head to be in.
Like, I was literally just thinking that as you were talking about that. I'm like, oh, now I want to read this book more just to understand what Miriam's doing and kind of be like, so you're literally just replacing one lover for the next. I'm like, that's really toxic narcissistic behavior. What are you doing?
Yes. She's like 6,000 years old.
Yes.
But to treat all of your lovers as interchangeable because you don't want to deal with the emotional devastation of losing them, like,
dude,
that's not just narcissism. That is top shelf narcissism.
In 6,000 years, this bitch never went to therapy.
Right? Like, spend some time alone, Miriam. Live it up. Solo life.
She's a serial monogamist, but like in the worst way possible.
I love that, though, right? You know, there's something so great. You know, I don't think Bowie gets a ton of great showy moments. He's actually quite understated in this movie, which is fun to consider his onstage persona compared to John. But I do love that moment where he gets really accusatory and he's kind of like, well, who do you have next? You know, like, who's going to take care of you when I'm gone?
Also, all these fuckers have to listen to them fuck for 300 years. And so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, I've been listening to this bitch fuck for 6,000 years. Oh, she just did the Sherry trick again, everybody. Good job, Miriam.
She pulled out the Sherry. Get them nips out.
She's playing the love song of the two lovers. Yeah, all the right moves.
I was going to say, do y'all think that Eli Roth was intentionally homaging this movie when he does his underwater lesbian porno scene? Because it's the same fucking song. Oh, sorry, in Piranha 3D.
Oh, I was like, what movie are you talking about? I don't know, possibly?
I wouldn't be surprised. We've talked about it before. Eli Roth is very media literate, so he likely knows The Hunger.
And he's like, lesbians. Oh, that
he
song
does like
from
lesbians
The Hunger.
Too.
Yeah.
As we discussed in Hostel 2, he does like lesbians.
And Piranha 3D.
Although technically that's Alexander Aja's film.
Oh, right. Oh, shit. Oh, my God. I'm cutting that out. Oh, shit. Fuck. No, go ahead.
You okay?
No, I just realized. I've been thinking the entire time. Eli Roth did Piranha 3D.
Well, I think because he's like an executive producer.
He's
in it.
He's involved at some point.
Mm-hmm. He told Alexander Asha.
He was like, you know what would be a great little scene? Have a bit with Sherry. And Alexander Aja was like, no, that's Catherine Deneuve's bit. I'm not doing that. Well, how about tits out underwater ballet sequence?
Now I have to keep it in.
Sold.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Okay, so, yes. So, John is declining quicker and quicker. He shows Miriam that his hair is falling out, and he asks how long he's got, because he knows that this has happened before, but he either thinks that he's going to just flat out die, or that Miriam can give him some kind of answers, right? Like, he seems so scared because he didn't know that this was going to happen, which is ironic because you're like, but you just mentioned Lolia.
Well, okay, but the sad thing about this is he is so upset because he's like, oh my God, I'm not going to live forever. I'm going to die. And it's like, girl, wait.
You never considered this. You never thought about it.
Yeah. Well, also, too, to imagine aging so rapidly. Yes. Like, I was really struck by the sections of the film where we're watching John aging, like you were saying, Joe, like looking in the mirror, seeing the wrinkles, seeing the liver spots. And also one scene that really hit me is where he's sitting so close to the TV just to hear it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, my goodness.
Oh.
Like all the typical things that as someone is aging, they start, you know, experiencing these changes. And I guess it's like as we are all aging, we're sitting here being like, oh, I'm feeling this. I don't like this at all. So imagine all that happening within like a couple days period.
Wait, do I have progeria? Am I also like that X-Files episode about the kids who age rapidly?
Oof.
Answer, no, we're just aging normally.
But I do like the way the aging, because it's he goes to see Sarah, you know, and he's like waiting in the patient's room. I love that it's not like the Wolfman type thing where we're just kind of like seeing him in one frame age. Right. It's every time we cut back to him, he's just a little bit older.
Yeah. Ah, it's so good.
Which felt very symbolic of sitting in a waiting room in a doctor's office.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm dying as I'm waiting to be seen.
I never even considered that, but honestly, that's really funny.
It's so true. And particularly when she says, you know, I'll be back in 15 minutes. And he's like, okay, 15 minutes. And then she leaves and never comes back.
She thought he was a crank.
She did think he was a crank. Admittedly, he just walks into her office like, hi, I'm here. You should treat me. And
I was 30 yesterday.
She's kind of a busy, important person.
Yeah, she de-escalated that situation quite well, though, because that can be quite terrifying for a woman in a restricted area, being like, what are you doing here? Why are you yelling at me?
Well, he grabs her, too. I'm just like, oof, dude.
Well, he's wearing sunglasses and a trench coat and a hat, too.
There's
sir,
a flasher are in the
you
room.
A flasher? Okay, so let's take all of the fun out of things by introducing AIDS into the mix, shall we?
Oh, God. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So I read a couple of different pieces from people who said, you know, the AIDS metaphor is very easy to read into this movie, particularly in these scenes with John as we start to see him go, right? So when he goes to visit Sarah, he says, look at my hand, look at the liver spots. I was a young man yesterday. And I think for people who went through the AIDS crisis, they can see a lot of how people were mishandled by medical professionals who didn't take their concerns seriously, but also just how quickly people can decay from being super healthy and happy and normal, quote unquote, one day. And then the next day, you know, they're in the hospital, they're losing their hair, they've got, you know, marks on their skin and that kind of stuff. So I've got another reference from Michaud. So she says, people with AIDS are metaphorically represented in this film with vivid imagery. The extremely rapid aging and horrifying death of John, the themes of blood exchange and scientific experiments, and deviant sex all point to a subtle AIDS reference.
I guess this is 83. So this is like the very, very, very beginning of the AIDS crisis, huh?
Yeah, so the book was written in 81, and apparently that's when we started to get reports of like, doctor, something weird is going on,
yeah.
But we didn't have a name for it, but the designation AIDS, I think, would have come out around 83. So, like, this film hits right as we're naming the disease.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and then it definitely... gets stronger in its messaging. I know for me, when Sarah is churned, when she has, and then particularly that poignant scene where she's having her blood examined, and they're like talking about the blood. You're like, oh yeah, and the way they start treating her and how she's struggling with it all.
When they are like, show me your arm, I'm like, fuck no, let's show me your arm.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, there's a weird judginess to the way that they treat her. And I do think that that's where the quote-unquote deviant sex comes in, right?
Yeah.
Because on one hand, it looks like an injection site, because this movie is very much doing the vampire as addict. But then it also kind of looks like a really gross hickey. And you can feel like they're judging her because, well... Sarah, what have you been up to? Who have you been seeing? Who have you been fucking?
Oh, are you getting a bit more antagonistic towards her? You want to know why she's lying to you? Maybe that makes you an asshole, generic white man.
Yeah, and she could have that fear herself because, like, she just probably just had her first sexual experience with a woman, right? So she's having this identity. She's like, oh my goodness, I've never experienced this before. I'm, you know, kind of coming to terms with herself and her sexuality. And then to have, you know, this thing happening with her body and her blood and, you know, bringing that back to the whole AIDS allegory and HIV crisis, you're like, hidden.
Yeah, it's interesting in some ways because I can already guarantee you there's going to be a bunch of people who don't see it. Maybe we're reaching too much. But as we said, I actually think this one is the most explicit of the ones that we've mentioned.
Yeah, I feel like we've reached... I'm trying to think of what AIDS, The Forsaken was 100% AIDS. Like that, and that was like 2001 vampire shit. Near Dark is even very AIDS-y because there's a whole blood transfusion thing in that movie.
Oh shit, that was the other... That's the third one.
Oh, yes. And that is 86, I think. I think that's 86.
No, you're right. It's 87.
Oh, fuck. Okay. Well, nevertheless.
But I think also
it's all the 80s.
Yeah, but I think also what gives this allegory more, like, the scene more strength is because Sarah is also involved in this researching, right? And they're researching on animals. Because obviously around the time, they're going to be doing the same thing in the 80s of trying to research this disease, find out what's going on, how is it changing people. And even though we're using the metaphor of age, of immortality and age and stuff like that, it's still a metaphor of there is this disease that's rapidly changing people, you know, taking their lives. And, you know, they've had to test on something. They tested on animals to do that. And that's kind of where Sarah's role comes in. Because as a scientist, she knows that things aren't good. Things are not going to go well for her.
Well, but and what sets this movie apart from all those other films we've just discussed, though, is that this is at the very, like, again, the first year, the year that the word AIDS, the phrase AIDS, became an actual term.
Right.
And I don't know if that means anything, but I think it makes this film, if anything, more interesting or fascinating from that AIDS perspective than Fright Night, than Near Dark, than Lost Boys.
Well, it almost makes it seem prescient, right?
Yes.
Like, because this film was in production before we even sort of knew what was happening. Mm-hmm. So it makes it seem as though it knows something is coming, even though you could say, oh, well, this is just a generic vampire film. Like, we're always talking about blood and exchanges of fluids and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people may, like, argue that it's like, well, it's a sex scene between two women, right? Like, that can't necessarily, like...
Oh my God.
That can't happen, but you're like, but at the same time too, we're like, no, safe sex, like transfer of fluids and stuff like that. Like, it can happen to anyone. Like, no one is safe from this, from AIDS. Like, that's just perceptions.
Well, that's also interesting, right? Yeah, because we have females dealing with this AIDS allegory in this movie, as opposed to the male vampires that we get in this other films we mentioned.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think one other way to look at it is because as we mentioned, there's a lot of cross-cutting in this movie. So as we're watching John deteriorate as he's waiting in the patient's lounge, you know, we're seeing this fantastic makeup by Dick Smith, the guy who did The Godfather, Exorcist, Amadeus, Death Becomes Her, the 1999 House on Haunted Hill.
And Scanners. Others.
And Scanners.
I'm just saying, you left out the Cronenberg, and that's not like you.
I don't love Scanners.
I know, it's fine. It's aggressively fine.
But, I mean, yeah, makeup job in this is fantastic. Like, the way that John transitions between, like, all the years is so interesting and compelling. But we're also watching this as we're watching this horrifying monkey video where the monkey is deteriorating and just, like, rotting away. And that's obviously a time lapse because they're looking at it over a longer period of time. But it's very easy to see, oh, okay, this is what the disease does to you. So it's, yes, we're saying it's aging, but the reality is, as we, because we're reading it through John's perspective, we're looking at it as a kind of viral blood-based infection.
And really, that's how the scientific community would treat Miriam, like almost like a specimen, right? Like, she's this, yes, has this blood about her, so it's, the blood would be, yeah, no. I'm just saying, mm-hmm. I'm just repeating what you just said. Yep, blood disease.
It's okay. We forgive you.
Okay, so John gets really pissed off and he ends up almost attacking an orderly in the bathroom, but he's interrupted. So he yells at Sarah, leaves the hospital. This movie loves to do near car accidents for some reason. I don't quite know why, but there's three of them in this movie where someone nearly gets run over in a crosswalk.
They're the days. They're just thinking.
I wonder if it's also just like you could die at any minute, right? Like, you could die crossing the street.
Yeah, but I mean, even Sarah's later film, I think that's more meant to emphasize their telepathic connection that they have to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, sure. Yeah.
Which, sure. So then John attacks somebody on roller skates in an underpass, and then that's when he goes home, and poor Alice is just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we get, I think this is probably one of the most stylishly shot murder sequences I've ever seen.
I don't disagree, but can you explain?
I think it's just, yeah, so it's really drawn out initially, mm-hmm, where Alice wants to come in, John doesn't want to let her in. She asks whether he's John's father because they have the same eyes, and you realize she's way more perceptive than you realize, mm-hmm, and he's hiding in the shadows behind the blinds. Finally comes into the light. He asks her to play this music. Like, it's just, you're waiting for it. You know it's coming. And then when he finally attacks her, we just see him lift her up from behind, and then we get, like, extreme close-ups of the blade slashing skin. But it's obviously not this young actor who's being injured. But the way it's all edited, it feels frantic and visceral and just really deeply upsetting, but also beautiful. And then, as you both said, we end with those images of the sheet music falling on the ground and being soaked through in blood.
I do find this scene incredibly tense, but I almost wonder if people didn't find it tense because they were like, well, they're not going to kill this little girl.
Maybe.
Well, I remember when I first saw that scene, I didn't think Alice was going to die. So I found her, remember it being either, very, yeah, striking. I was just like, oh my God, he actually killed her. Because, like,
yeah,
it was just like early on and with horror movies being like, no, children don't die in horror movies. Now, right, I'm, what's the word? Jaded. I'm just like, yeah, a child dies in horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
So much more often than you expect.
Desensitized, whatever.
But it's still beautiful because it's, you know, it's in the 80s. You can't really want to upset too many people with that. And like Joe was saying earlier, like, we really liked Alice in the beginning. She's like a likable character. And even, mm-hmm, when she's buzzing at the door, I'm just like, don't go in, stay away, like, stranger danger. Like, you don't know this person. But she's just like, no, it's fine, it's good. And you're like, this is not going to go well.
I mean, one of the things that I find really interesting, too, is that we as an audience know a bit more than John and definitely Alice. But when I see this happening, I just think to myself, John, this is a desperate play. This won't work. And you know it because,
well, no, he doesn't.
Nothing can stop what's already begun. So we know he's actually just killing this girl for no reason, too.
No, but I mean, yes, she has told him, like, this happens to all my lovers, but it's one of those things where, I mean, he's been alive for 300 years, and so he's just like, you're right, it's desperation, but I do think that he believes that this might work for him.
I also think, because I'm going to bring in, like, the monstrous vampire,
oh yes,
aspect into it, you've been a creature that's been living off of the blood of humans for centuries. You eat once mm-hmm. out of every 7 days. So
yes.
You do this for life. You've built an instinct, right? And as a vampire, you're going to sense blood. You're going to sense people around you, hearing the heart, stuff like that. They have these extrasensory perceptions. But as right. he's aging, his mind is also decaying. And now he's a threat. Oh. He's a danger because we've seen from the moment he leaves the medical building to the house, he is almost like given up their cover a couple times because he tried to kill the orderly. Mm-hmm. He tried to almost kill the young man roller skating, dancing under the underpass there and fails. And then he kills Alice. Now he's got the police on their backs. So like he's a threat now because he can't control his vampiric urges.
Right.
And that is fascinating, Jess. I never considered the fact that because he is, to a certain extent, he's becoming an old man, so he almost doesn't have his mental faculties about him anymore.
Yeah, like he's kind of going to that place of just being like, well, I've known the blood is supposed to keep me alive, so I'll just keep on right. I'll just keep drinking the blood to keep me alive. But also it's this animal, and this is one of the other things I find in this film, there's this animalisticness to being a vampire, and the way that Miriam and John, like, they hunt their prey, there are a lot of the stalking, the way they mm-hmm. they kind of interact with people and stuff like that, like, they know they're on the top of the food chain, and
oh, for sure.
And there's just a lot of that in that, and even, like, in the sex scene later, too, like, everything is just this very primal with like the lust and I always find that with vampires that as they start losing their mental facilities, they're more dangerous to mm-hmm. protecting their lifestyles. And
it's because we as a society sexualize vampires so much, and because they are very sexy
yes.
until they're not.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's what vampire films love to do, right? They say, oh, they're sexy, but they're also creatures, right? Like,
yeah.
They can't be reasoned with because they are driven by this insatiable hunger, hence the title of the film.
But at least they don't say it in the movie.
No, they
do. Oh, she does say it.
She does say the yeah. hunger.
Oh, well, shit.
She's like, you'll never be able to escape the hunger when Sarah mm-hmm. tries to leave.
That's when she goes out and yeah. gets the trick.
Got it. Well, speaking of her, though, she comes home and she finds this fucker. And to uh-huh. connect it to Kelly's previous episode with us, she looks at him and it reminds me of Bride of Chucky whenever Tiffany's all burnt up by the oven. And she goes, like, she's like, Chucky, hold me. And he's like, ugh. Just lets her fall.
Yeah,
that's Miriam, how she feels about him.
That's literally how Miriam feels about John now. She's just like,
yeah.
Don't touch me. Yeah. I don't want to look at you. You're dying. I don't like death. I don't want to be reminded that you're dying. So time to carry you to your box.
Bitch is in
you're
denial.
Both so mean.
She's in denial.
Okay, I don't entirely disagree with you because she clearly is unhappy with what has happened to John. I don't think she's disgusted by him. I think, yeah, she just doesn't want to have to see him that way because it reminds her, oh, this has happened so many times before, and also, I don't like death.
No, yes. No. It reminds her that she's a terrible fucking person.
That too, because I can imagine being alive for as long as she would. She would have to have some introspection at some point, being like, what I'm doing doesn't seem right.
Well, no, because the most villainous villains, the most interesting villains, are the ones that don't actually think they're villains. They think that they are right. doing something that is good. That,
she just thinks that she's loving these people, and then they disappoint her by not being the one, right? Like, she tells John near the end that she thought it was going to be different, that he was going to be the miracle that would kind of break this curse.
That
so
is denial.
I think that's why she keeps bringing yeah. in new companions.
Yeah,
right?
But it's also because seeing them in this state every time reminds her that she's a stupid bitch.
She literally does not love them to death.
Well, yeah. And so she would rather not look at them, but keep them for her own mm-hmm. love and safety. But she can't look at them because it's like, oh, right, I'm a horrible person that's dooming these people to this horrible existence.
Right. She's almost like a serial killer, right? She keeps the tokens in the attic.
Yeah, the tokens, just their husks of a body. Ugh, husk, that's such a gross word.
Yeah, so that's basically it. I mean, I love the imagery of someone like Catherine Deneuve carrying this husk of a body into the elevator and then up through the attic, because the elevator doesn't even go to the attic, so she then has to, like, negotiate another stairwell and another hallway, and then we're into, like, weird Hellraiser dream sequence territory where it's, yeah, the open yeah. attic, and there's pigeons, and there's mist and stuff.
Okay, the sound of pigeon wings, I thought it was doves, actually. It's like but nevertheless, bird wings flying around this place. Also, I have this image of David Bowie being like, what's in the West Wing? Like Beauty and the Beast. And it's just the bodies of all of her dead lovers.
we don't go there.
The West Wing is off limits.
So yeah, that's basically the end of David Bowie in this movie. And then we move over to the Sarah portion of the film. So Sarah shows up at the house the next day. She wants to apologize for how she treated John. Miriam's already, baby. Oh, John, he's in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Sure he is. In that condition, he just hopped on an intercontinental flight, I guess.
No, I call my attic Switzerland.
It's a neutral territory. So Sarah leaves because she's not getting anywhere, and then we introduce a new character who really doesn't play much of a role in this movie, but lo and behold, Dan Hedaya shows up as Lieutenant Allegreza.
Right? Random.
So very random. He plays Tully in the Addams Family, does he not?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so I remember when I first saw him, I was like, it's Tully! And that's
See, for me, he'll always be Dick and Dick.
Oh, yes, that's true, yep.
But I will say, though, this character, not needed in this movie.
No, it feels like this is maybe something where when we read the book, this character will either have a more substantial part or it'll just factor into the plot more.
Something, but yeah, yeah. I mean, which granted, I don't want a stupid murder investigation in this movie. No. I don't need it. That is not what this movie's about. But yeah, this whole scene, it's like, okay. But we don't see him again until the very, very end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's meant to imply, as you said, Jess, just that Miriam has to be a little bit more careful because the popo are kind of poking around the residence.
Yeah, and that's how I read it. It's just like, okay, her safe haven has been threatened now, so she needs to act quickly, and then eventually she's going to have to leave and move.
Which is ironic because that's what Sarah does.
Yeah,
so she's like, I need to get some fresh puss.
Yeah. And imagine Miriam doesn't stay in the same house of the lover, the house that she lived in with one lover, and she just moves into another one.
Can you imagine the neighbors? Hey, you always used to have that guy, and then that girl went missing, and then all of a sudden you're shacked up with that new young hot girl. What's going on with you?
But she has the same hair.
You a bit of a swinger?
But that new girl has the same hair as that guy that you once had that's not there anymore, so I'm really confused.
So, yes, we're now full-time Sarah watchers. I do love this part where she's in the shower and she keeps thinking that she's hearing the phone ringing.
Mm-hmm.
Shitty Tom refuses to answer it, and or the phone is not actually ringing. This is Miriam putting it in her head. But at night, when they go to bed, Sarah is almost doing the same thing that John was doing where she can't sleep because she's just up thinking about things.
Yeah, she got in her head, literally. Yeah.
So she does end up going to see Miriam the next day, and she even says to Miriam, I don't know why I'm here.
Oh, I actually love that moment. Like, she you can tell she's trying to think of something to say, and then she's like, I don't know why I'm here. And she's like, oh, it's okay. Come in. Let me fuck you.
More or less.
Yeah.
You're here because I want you in my bed.
I willed it.
Exactly. I literally put, like, you are enraptured by me now, so come.
Mm-hmm.
Come to my bed with a mirror in it.
So then basically Miriam wines and dines, not quite literally, but she basically woos Sarah by saying all of this could be yours. Like, I've got some sherry that you can splash on your tits, and I've also got all of this, like, gorgeous real estate. Look at how amazing this place is. So she's more or less saying, you know, hey, if you want to be with me, this is the kind of thing that you get. And then she starts to play Leo Delibes' flower duet. And I love that the film makes a joke about this, you know. Isn't that a love song between two women? I guess it is.
Well, No. She goes, is this a love song? Well, it's two women singing it. Well, it sounds like a love song. Guess it is. Also, I have this fan machine over here, this wind machine.
The power bill in this brownstone would be outrageous because we just have fans going all the time.
So I will say that. So they were in this scene. There were a few body doubles used in shots because Susan Sarandon had just had a laparoscopy. It's one of those surgeries where they have to stick a tube in your belly button to look at your gut. So she didn't want her stomach exposed on camera. But nevertheless, it was a closed set because apparently everyone on the film wanted to be in the room. And Tony Scott was like, no.
That's gross, guys. We don't do that.
Yeah.
But okay, back to the male gaze portion of this. I mean, like, we've had this discussion before. I you know, obviously it's not just male. It could be, just as you said, queer male, bisexual male, queer woman. I just... there's something, as I said earlier, so classy about the way that this is shot. None of this feels lurid. It is erotic and it is sensual. This doesn't feel porny to me.
Well, this film is considered an erotic horror.
I saw that and I thought, wow, okay, how deep a cut is that?
I'm like, Joe's the expert. yeah, it's considered an erotic horror, and I find that scene to be... it is very artsy, like, right up to the point, like, even when the point of, like, she gets in the bed and there's a mirror, and it reminds me of, there's an art piece out there of a woman with, like, a mirror and, like, a half-clothed woman sitting in front of it, and I'm just like, that's gorgeous. This is beautiful. Like, the white gauze everywhere, and it's very tender.
It's hot.
It's hot, yeah. Sorry.
No, it really
She's like,
is.
I'm sorry. I was drooling.
I literally had to stop for a minute. I was like, oh, yeah.
I got the vapors.
Well, it's funny because I feel like 17-year-old me would have told my mom, no, I'm just watching an artsy horror film, if I had tried to stay up late so that I could, you know, see nudity. But the reality is, it's like, this is tasteful to a degree that we don't often see in specifically horror movie sex scenes, right? Like, let's think of Friday the 13th, the remake, where we've just got that chick bouncing on top of the dude with her tits out, and she's like, ah, this feels so good.
He's like, you got perfect nipple placement, baby. Your tits are stupendous.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I recognize that that's a completely different subgenre of horror. It's meant to be jokey and stupid. But, you know, this feels like, oh, we're making an art film that just happens to be horror for adults. Like, do we want to say elevated horror? Sure.
But even of the time, though. I mean, like, look, yeah, we've had The Vampire Lovers in the 60s. Maybe 70s. So we've had lesbian vampires before, but I guess because this is American, it is a major studio film. Like, this, something about this scene, I'm just like, oh, it feels very progressive and almost taboo for the time period.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring Michelle back in because she does speak specifically to the lesbian sex scene. She says the mise-en-scene for the lesbian love scene is awash with gauzy veils and flowing draperies, shot in a hazy, soft focus style. And that's the other piece we haven't really mentioned. The soft focus is, like, over the top here. Mm-hmm. Their lovemaking takes place without the need for any male presence. Though Miriam is decidedly the seducer and sexual aggressor, there is nothing particularly masculine in her behavior or that of Sarah. Their embraces and kisses are passionately, breathtakingly woman-oriented.
It reminds me very much like Daughters of Darkness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the kind of the love scene. Also, like, even going further back and thinking of Carmilla and how Carmilla will approach her lover in the bed at night. So I don't find this scene gratuitous at all. I find it very beautiful, honestly. I really enjoy this, how this is filmed, particularly between two women, and it's in a vampire film. Because, like we were saying earlier, a lot of other vampire lesbian movies are often the scenes are gratuitous. Like,
well, and that's why, I mean, look, I am not opposed to the term male gaze. It obviously exists. But what I'm asking people is to not just say, oh, a straight man did this, therefore it is male gazey.
Right.
Do a little bit more, have media literacy. Like, look at it. Like, observe the scene, what is actually happening. And to me, this scene is not male gazey.
Yeah, I mean, I think the term can definitely apply here because that is who Tony Scott is. Like, when you look at who shot the film, yes, it is done through a male gaze. But I think to do so diminishes the people who find the female form attractive, which is not only men, right? Like, I think we do a disservice to the queer viewers who might also be enjoying this. Like, I always go back to Nay's comment when we were joking about Showgirls, right? Where I was like, oh, this is so, like, exploitative and trashy. And Nay was like, well, I found it hot.
Same here.
And that's the thing. It is literally a male gaze, but it's not, quote unquote, the male gaze.
Well, and yeah, exactly that. Because we default assume, therefore, that it is for a male gaze of the audience.
Yes.
As though this movie is only intended for men. And I'm just like, okay, well, why would we arbitrarily decide that that is the benchmark?
Exactly. And I mean, I know that this is obviously like the highlight of the film, but it is the most memorable part of the film, just given everything that we've discussed and everything that's involved in it. But I also don't want this film to be limited to just this scene, because it is so much more than just this scene.
I agree. Yeah.
Now, I do want to throw a wrench into this. Mm-hmm. Not for the sake of being a shit disturber, but because I view this film not as an empowerment way, but I can definitely understand why queers would look at Miriam and say, I identify with her. She's powerful. She's sexual. She gets what she wants.
She's afraid of being alone.
Well, I mean, yeah, like she definitely has negative elements to her. But I guess I hadn't always, you know, I think of all of the queer monsters that we as queer audience members have identified with and why there's a power to that. Mm-hmm. But I was interested to see that Harry M. Benchoff, the guy that we have quoted so often, particularly with some of the older films, he specifically categorizes The Hunger as like a bad example of like the queer monster.
Oh, wow.
So he says The Hunger characterizes vampires as specifically homosexual or bisexual. This film has perhaps done much to cement into place the current social construction of homosexuals as unnatural, predatory, plague-carrying killers, even as they might also provide a pleasurable power view fulfillment fantasy for some queer viewers.
I mean, because when did he write that book?
It would have been, he was working on it in the 90s.
Okay. See, that makes a bit more sense, because here's the thing. I don't even disagree with what you just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a thing where it's in 2023 now, like we're in a much better place than we were in the 80s and 90s. We're not this great, but we're doing good. we're doing better.
We were doing so well for a couple of years, and then the last couple of years has been a bit of a backslide. But compared to like the height of the AIDS crisis, we're in a better place.
Yes, but I mean, I everything you said is right. But again, it's like, well, I think maybe it seems less bad in 2023 than it would have in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1992, it was like, yeah, we can't have any, I'm sorry, we can have negative portrayals of queer people, but it's like, that wasn't really what we want. I go back to, Basic Instinct, you know, where it's like,
right.
Catherine Tremell, to me, is a very empowering figure, but in the 90s, we didn't want that representation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I can understand where Benchoff is coming from with that assessment.
Yeah, no, I agree. I wanted to raise it because I don't know. There's something so compelling about Miriam in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, it kind of took me by surprise, because I did think of so many other characters where I was like, well, he doesn't come down so hard on those people. But I think specifically when we're talking about like vampire movies of the 80s.
Right.
It's a hard sell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is not a hard sell is dinner reservations at a restaurant where women just swim next to you.
Okay, wait, I'm sorry, but the match cut from the bite to mm-hmm. the steak getting cut is,
it's gross.
Kind of awesome.
It's great, but disgusting.
I wanted steak. So I watched this twice, because I watched it without the commentary and with the commentary, and both times I was like, fuck, I want a steak right now.
Jess, aren't you a vegetarian too?
Yes, I'm vegan. So
I want a vegan steak right now.
But that's okay, because then I'm just like, oh, it just, you know, to me, it goes back to my whole idea about cannibalism, being like, okay, well, you just referenced the human body part, and then you just showed us mm-hmm. animal flesh. So same thing, cannibalism. Okay, cool. We're moving on again.
Yeah. The hunger is pro-vegan.
meat is murder. Yeah. Yeah. So Tom really lays into Sarah about this 3-hour conversation that she had with a woman that she barely knows. And then just to kind of drive home how not great Sarah is feeling, we do get to watch her vomit all of this back up when they go home later on.
Also, that was apparently Susan Sarandon's first time vomiting on screen.
Oh.
Hmm. Is that an IMDb trivia?
That is a commentary trivia.
Okay.
She was like, yeah, this is my first time vomiting on screen. I tried to use the egg white and oatmeal trick.
Oh. That's disgusting. Mm. What I really appreciate about the scene, watching it again this time around, was we have two different things that we could interpret the scene with: her having that conversation with Tom and then her constantly looking over at the bodies. Because mm-hmm. you're thinking, mm-hmm. oh, she's now churning. She's just thinking about the bodies as, you know, actual, like, I'm going to, you know, eat them or something like that. But then I recognize, I'm like, she's mm-hmm. only looking at female bodies. So yes. Imagine. And so, of course, you know, as someone who was coming out and stuff like that, being like having your first experience with a woman being mind blowing. And then the next, you're sitting here having dinner with your partner. And then you're just looking over and you're like, just thinking about mm-hmm. it, right? Like that her mind is like completely different because you just had this life changing experience.
Literally yes. a life-changing experience.
Well, at this point, I think it's still a positive life-changing experience, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she doesn't know what's going on with her yet. Yeah. She's not feeling well, but she's at the same time too being like, oh my God, like, and that I'm not feeling well could just be like your nerves, like, oh my God, I just had this experience. Does this change everything about me, like my life, mm-hmm. right? And it's not until like when Tom is like, you need to go see a doctor. I remember being upset when he's like, you need to see a doctor. I'm like, dude, back off. Like,
she's not sick. She's just queer.
Yes.
Okay. But she is literally sick.
But she doesn't know yes. that. She doesn't know that yet.
I will say one of the things I do appreciate about this is that getting infected doesn't make her hot. Like, she was already hot. Mm. She doesn't get more hot or anything like that.
But you mean, like, Joe, like, physically, she all of a sudden, like, her physical appearances is no longer, like, she's not glowing or has this, like, she, you know, she still yes. looks like a really hot individual. It's just now she's sick.
Yeah, like, she doesn't get a movie makeover yeah. just because she's a vampire.
Yeah.
Okay, so after this scene, yeah, we run a blood test on Sarah, and then this is when her colleagues all kind of gang up on her. But we do hear that phrase where it's like, oh, it's a disease-resistant, inhuman strain of blood that you have in you. And it's like fighting for dominance.
It's that inhuman, right? Like, you're like, oh, you have something yeah. inhuman running through your veins. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is kind of fascinating if you do know the backstory from the novel, right? Where it's a little more alien. It is yeah. like a kind of properly otherworldly infection. Whereas in the course of this film, we don't know that. So it just feels like, oh, there's something just a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And then when they're kind of like interrogating her about like, okay, well, how did this happen? Stuff like that. And they show her arm to show those bite marks. And that's also where I get the idea of the addiction and drugs and stuff like that mm-hmm. too, because that was also a fear, right? Of sharing needles and stuff like that. And it could cause transmission. Yeah. And we get that junkie kind of mentality later on.
Yeah. So because of all this, Sarah goes to Miriam. She gets really mad at her. She tries to confront her physically. And this is when Miriam shows, oh, I'm actually quite strong. So no, that's not going to work for you. But yeah, Miriam does say that she'll be back when she needs to feed because she's going to go through it. So this is where we do a kind of like addict, you're going into withdrawal sequence. Sarah goes out. She doesn't look very stable on her feet. She's trying to hail a cab. She can't get someone to pick her up. She makes a phone call. She can't get a hold of Tom. I have a question. Where is Tom? Because she says she tries him at the lab and she tries him at home. And then when we see him making calls to try to find her, he's at home. But it's like, dude, where have you been?
That's a good question.
I think it's just like a weird gap in the yeah, film's logic. Yeah. But yeah. I was definitely like, Tom, you're shady. I don't trust you.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But I mean, she even gets mistaken. I think the intention is meant to be that she's mistaken for a sex worker when these two men,
yeah.
played by John Pacow and Willem Dafoe.
Yes, Willem Dafoe. Man,
God. I one of those things, I love Willem Dafoe. I've never found him like particularly attractive, but
he looks cute here.
Oh my God, he looks so attractive. Dafoe. He's hot with that leather jacket here. His like Grease style haircut.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. These are dodgy dudes, for sure. So she ends up going right back to Miriam because she's not feeling so hot. So Miriam puts her to bed. We see her shaking and sweating. And this is when Miriam says, well, I'll go out and get you someone to help you quell this hunger. So she returns with a man played by James Aubrey. And I love again that this kind of comes of nothing because this dude never even makes it to Sarah. Miriam just kills him in the elevator.
I know. I was like, are you going to, like, bottle up his blood for it? No. She's just like, I'm hungry.
Yeah. And then she just calls like, Sarah to her, like, telepathically she's yelling, but it sounds like it's telepathically because it's so dreamlike to be like, come, you are in your bed and you're like, almost, I guess you feel like you're dying, but come, I have food for you, like a couple stories down.
Yeah. But of course, that doesn't happen because Tom turns up, and when he sees what's become of Sarah, he tries to comfort her, but...
And she is like, leave! And he's like, no! Leave! And she's like, no!
All right.
I'll eat you.
Oh my god. And, mm-hmm. and Miriam is cold. She's just like, yeah, Sarah's here. She's upstairs. And you're like, damn.
Second door on the left.
Yeah, literally, like damn, you were cold. She's just like, yeah, I'll take care of itself. I'm gonna go sit down in my piano.
But it's not unlike what Dandridge does with Charlie and Amy in Fright Night, because he waits for him to go find her.
Yeah, it's true. Because I think it's one of those two birds with one stone's kind of thing, right? Like, I'll get rid of your ex, and I'll do so by feeding you. So, yeah, everybody wins in this situation. I do love that moment, though, that shot where we hear the struggle. Like, we don't see what happens to Tom because it doesn't matter. We know. So we're just watching Miriam as she's looking at the chandelier shaking and hearing the sounds of the struggle. And it cross-cuts with her presumed first time killing someone back in ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I just think, you know, this is really effective non-verbal storytelling. Like, you don't need to tell us that Tom's dead. We know. And then Sarah shows up, and she's covered in blood.
Oh,
and she looks happy.
That shot when she walks out with, like, the blood down her chin is so cool.
Yeah. Ooh. I like that, too.
Is it bad to say that she still looks sexy?
No, yeah. Nope. Yeah. Vampires are sexy. It's fine.
Yeah.
So this has got to be what, like, an hour and 15 minutes into the runtime?
Oh, yeah. Like, we're almost done. Yeah.
So this is when Miriam gives us the rules to this world of vampirism in the movie. So as you said, Jess, she needs to feed one day in every 7. She will sleep 6 hours in every 24. She will be young forever. And eventually, she will come to love Miriam the way that Miriam loves her.
Which, bitch, you've known her for like a week.
Not even. I think it's been like maybe 36 hours.
Well, and that's why we're the book where it's like, oh, like she's been following her for years. Like that makes more sense. But in this, it's like, no, you're just a bunch of U-Haul lesbians.
Not wrong. And also the way she introduces all this to Sarah, she's like, I am damned to live forever. So I'm going to bring other people on this journey with me. And you're like, oh.
Right? I feel like at a certain point, if I were Miriam, I would kill myself at a certain point.
I mean, I think you would become, oh shit, what's the Brad Pitt character from Interview with the Vampire?
Louis, yeah.
Yeah, you would just get tired of it all, right? There would be no new pleasures and you would realize, well, this just isn't fun anymore.
Yeah, but he chooses to keep living, which was stupid.
Well, I mean, Louis
he's a sad sack.
Like, I guess if it's really hard to kill yourself, and we all have potentially like a fear of death, and I guess even for like vampires, they essentially fear death. But yeah, sure. but when you go around and say, well, I'm damned to live like this forever, I'm like, well, you could fix that. You could just let someone off you. But
and if you're worried about going to hell if you die by suicide, I mean, you probably killed enough people to, you know, you're going to hell no
matter
what.
You're going there
anyway. Yeah, and the fact
you're going to the bad place.
And the fact that you keep bringing people on this journey with you, and you keep saying, I will love you forever, 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 and forever, and you will eventually learn to love me forever, and you're like, wait. Oof. Like, and Sarah knows this. Like, Sarah met John. She's got suspicions of what's happening around here.
Sarah's like, what's in the West Wing? And also, didn't you just have that fuck boy for like 200 years, 24 hours ago?
Right? Like, I just saw him age really fast in 2 hours. So is that going to happen to me?
Yes. serial monogamist. You were like, oh, well, that guy's done. Move on to the next one. You're like,
It's wild. I mean, presumably Sarah does think all of these things because she goes for a kiss and then she stabs herself in the neck.
But then Miriam's like, oh, honey, that's not going to work.
I do love that Miriam doesn't even try to change her mind. She's like, well, up into the attic with you now, too.
Like, she can't be alone for, like, a day.
No. Honestly, the thesis of this movie is codependence.
Yes.
Miriam, girl, you got to learn to travel on your own. You know what? Like, go out and just be by yourself. Find out who is the real Miriam.
Some real self-care and R&R.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for someone like Sarah. Like, she's clearly a woman of the 80s. She's out there for her career. She wants to be successful. She's independent. She doesn't even, like, she's affirmative with her boyfriend Tom. I don't think she will appreciate being in a codependent relationship
for the next 200 yes. years. Sarah's like, ooh, I didn't really sign on for this, sorry.
Okay, so then explain to me what happens here. So she brings Sarah up, and then all of a sudden these husks that can't move bust out of their coffins and kill her ass.
You betcha.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it.
I think it's mostly, it's something to do with the fact that they are sick and tired of Miriam pulling this shit, right? Like, she's deposited two new bodies in the space of 24 hours, and then they all recognize, oh, she's just going to go out and find someone new again. So I get the impression this is very much a pent-up ex-revenge scheme. But it also feels like an old Tales from the Crypt style finale, though, doesn't it? Right? Like, oh no, I'm the person who caused my own demise when all of my exes come back as husks and kill me.
Well, and it's funny, this is probably not an intentional homage, but having just caught up on Apple TV's Servant, her fall down the stairs reminds me a lot of a certain character's fall down the stairs in that season 3 finale.
Yeah.
Even the way it's shot, like...
Oh, man. I talked about Alice's death sequence as being exquisitely beautifully shot. Watching Catherine Deneuve fall in slow motion as she screams down what appears to be 12 to 15 stories of this house, it is so stunning to watch.
Now, wait. Are these so these stairs, it's the 12 to 15 flights of stairs to the elevator?
No, I think it's from the attic all the way down to the bottom. It's just that the elevator only goes to
so
the
far up,
top
yeah.
floor.
Okay, gotcha. That makes more sense.
No idea why.
Movie.
Sure.
Yeah, so they attack her, and this is always what got me confused in the movie, is that we think she's dying. Like, we know she's aging and stuff like that, and you... think that she's dead because you see everyone else die. So we're like, oh, okay, when she dies, they can all
die. Yeah, they all die.
Exactly.
But no. Yes.
Well, do we think it's just because Sarah, like, hasn't completed the transformation yet?
No. Okay. Because here's the thing. This was supposed to be the end of the fucking movie. This was supposed to be it.
Okay.
The scene of Sarah... Sorry, so we got one more scene of Dan Hedaya coming back, and he's like, oh, like, where's... Yeah. I gotta talk to her.
And
oh, she's gone.
Oh, yeah. They're selling the building. Yeah. Everybody's dead. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
The final scene of Sarah on the balcony was added at the studio's behest, with a view to leaving the film open-ended because they wanted sequels to this movie before it flopped. And
really,
yeah,
yes, on the Blu-ray, Sarandon talks about it, and she goes, she expresses regret. She goes, the thing that made the film interesting to me was this question of, would you want to live forever if you were an addict? But as the film progressed, the powers that be rewrote the ending and decided that I wouldn't die. So what was the point? All the rules that we'd spent the entire film delineating, that Miriam lived forever and was indestructible, and all the people that she transformed eventually died, and that I killed myself rather than be an addict, were ignored. Suddenly, I was kind of living, she was kind of half dying, nobody knew what was going on, and I thought that was a shame.
Exactly. That's exactly
interference.
Yeah, I have a feel about that, because, like, the movie ends so perfectly. You're like, okay, cool. Miriam's dead, everyone's dead, the film's over, and then, yeah... all of a sudden, you see that she's alive, and you're asking yourself, like, well, how does she live then?
Yeah, it underwrites the entire logic of the film,
and then they show
right?
us that Miriam is now locked away in her own coffin, so we're like, okay, well, now Miriam still... So shouldn't all of her lovers still be alive?
Well, and it's like, how did they switch roles? Like, how did that even happen? Now, granted, there is a bit of a good-for-her ending in this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the poetic justice of the idea of Miriam being trapped in a box forever.
Yes, but it doesn't make any sense.
No.
And it seems... that, like, Sarah's character goes the more polyamorous route and has two lovers at the same time instead of just one.
I did like that.
But I still don't know how she feels about her life, given what we had just seen in the last scene.
Yeah,
it almost would have been better if it had been set further in the future so we could know that she's had 100 years to think about it, right? But, of course...
She's in Blade Runner.
She's in Blade Runner. She's wearing, like, a transparent trench coat, and she's got a boa constrictor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she does look, like, at the end, like, she looks... What's the word, like, you know, sad and forlorn and like, I've made a I can't die now. I made a horrible choice. And I was like, but that doesn't make any sense. So I'm glad to know that that was studio interference because, yeah, I particularly don't like that last bit of the film.
I completely forgot this even happened.
To even have Sarandon be like, yeah, that sucks.
Sometimes I sign on and you know what it is. She didn't read the fine print and the asterisk at the bottom of the contract.
But I can you imagine like a series of sequels for this?
I could. I mean, you talked about it kind of as your proposed television spinoff.
And well, the book does have sequels.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It follows Miriam as she gets a new companion, right?
I actually just discovered that they had sequels too. And so I was just like, oh, it's two sequels. The Last Vampire from 2001 and then Lilith's Dream, a dream up for the vampire life in 2003. So I'm curious to see where it goes from a 1981 film about Miriam Blaylock to all of a sudden this almost like when I, and anytime I see the word The Last Vampire, I always think of the Christopher Pike novel. And I'm just like, that's The Last Vampire I want to read about. So now I'm like, what is this sequel about? Are we carrying on with Sarah? Are we carrying on with Miriam? Is it one of Miriam's lives, like one of her lovers?
So I do know for sure that at the end of the first novel, Miriam kills Sarah.
Oh.
And the second book follows her.
Okay.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
See, now I do want to read this. God damn it. Well, nevertheless, that is how the movie ends. And that is The Hunger. So, both of you. Actually, Jess, first you. Any final thoughts on this film?
So many. I really appreciate this film a lot because it is a different take of vampirism. It's particularly coming out in the 1980s where, like you said earlier, we had so many films like Fright Night and Lost Boys where, you know, it was fun to be a vampire and you're always dealing with male vampirism. But I love seeing films that deal with female vampirism and relationships and all the allegories that's in this film dealing with loneliness, aging, the HIV, you know, opening up your sexuality, and also just identity. Like, every time I watch this film, I see something new, and I really appreciate it, and I think it's earned its kind of cult status in the queer community over the years, and I think it takes different perspectives to keep reviewing it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just as shocked that I liked this movie as much as I did. I love the new, I guess to me, new take on vampires. I love the queer content. I understand the style over substance, but again, there is enough substance here, especially on a second viewing where I'm like, there's like maybe the movie isn't projecting it out there, but it's very much in every frame of this movie.
Yeah, I feel the same way as the pair of you. I do feel like the more interested perspective of female vampirism as opposed to some of the earlier iterations that we had seen, which were a little bit more titillating and sensational. I really appreciate that. And it does often feel like we're more prone to seeing like male vampires being predators and stuff. So this is interesting to watch a bad female vampire who is also incredibly sexy and kind of relatable in the fact that she's a bit of a garbage human being. And while I'll acknowledge that the end of the film doesn't satisfy any of us, I do want to give the last word to Michelle. So I've quoted this person several times over the course of the recording, but I thought this was an interesting take on the finale. So Sarah's position is not unlike that of many lesbians and radical feminists in the 1980s. She lives off the grid in a world of her own creation because there is no place for her in the culture from which she came. She can only exist as a renegade, a shadowy outcast who resides in a twilight world.
Oh.
Yeah, I just thought that that was an interesting way of framing it because there's other parts of that piece that talks about how basically there wasn't a place for female spectators. So the idea of a feminine gaze or a queer gaze was often negated by the fact that we didn't have those people writing about film or reviewing films in the 80s. And then particularly the way that we wanted to talk about the male gaze and how it was like all oppressive and that kind of stuff. It's like, well, so what happens to Sarah is kind of what happens to queers and women's.
Well, that's depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy, happy, happy.
On
happy the hunger.
That everybody. Note. Well, before we announce what we're covering next week, Jess, thank you for coming on to talk about this. And let everyone know, where can they find you on social media?
They can find me under the Spinsters of Horror. So we're the Spinsters of Horror on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And then my own personal social media is at Spectral Jess on both Instagram and Twitter. And you can find our podcast, our Spit on Your Podcast, on any podcasting app that you can find us on. We're going to be recording our new episode, which will be on necrophilia, female necrophilia. We'll be talking about Necromantic 2 and the film Kissed. And so that will be out at the end of the month. Yes. God.
I'm like, I was
Canadian
like,
well, content.
Necrophilia. Yes. I was like, Neon Demon and Dead Girl are my two like necrophilias.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Kelly has banned me from seeing Dead Girl. She's like, Jessica, you're never allowed to watch that film.
It is extremely upsetting.
It's a rough movie, but I would argue worth watching. But yes, okay.
You will have lots of interesting conversations. Also, you will never touch another, like, male penis.
Well, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at HorrorQueers. Shoot us an email at horrorqueers@gmail.com. Find us on Letterboxd to keep track of all the films we've covered. Go to our YouTube channel to check out our interviews with various horror filmmakers. If you want to chat with other listeners, please join our Facebook Horror Queers group. If you want to show us some love, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you want even more content, please support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/horrorqueers. We are now in April, so go sign up and you can get 233 hours of extra content. New episodes this month include a discussion on films with make or break endings, the latest remake of The Children of the Corn, the new horror comedy Renfield, Amazon Prime's Beyonce-ish horror series Swarm, and an audio commentary on Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses for its 20th anniversary.
Oh my god.
I know, so much. But
stop that.
Joe.
Yes.
What are we talking about next week? New film for me, by the way.
Yeah, it's actually a new film for me as well. We tease that we're sticking in vampires because we said last week that we're doing 2 weeks of them. We're going to go even further into the past, Chase, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Ganja and Hess.
Yeah, this is, I know nothing about this movie except for the brief tidbits that you and some other guests have. I think maybe Xena Dixon told us about this or talked to us about this.
Most likely. It's a very important horror noir.
Yes, there we go. So yeah, everyone, until next week with Ganja and Hess, we can cross out The Hunger.
Indeed. And cross out Horror Queers.